Lo que no hace, lo toca mati. 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 En el hueca a donatiu, donatiu,
welcome to the National Native Network podcast series. Today we're presenting our webinar archive, Mitigating the Financial Burdens of Breast Cancer Treatment, presented on April 26, 2023. To view the webinar video and additional resources, please visit our website, keepitsacred.org, and click the Resources tab and the Webinar Archive tab. Please enjoy our presentation.
Hello, my name is Mike Willett with the National Native Network, a program of the Intertribal Council of Michigan. Welcome to the NNN webinar series on cancer risk reduction in Indian Country. This webinar is titled, Mitigating the Financial Burdens of Breast Cancer Treatment. This technical assistance webinar is being hosted by the National Native Network, which offers technical assistance and resources for commercial tobacco and cancer prevention and control throughout Indian Country and the Indian Health Service Clinical Support Center. Your presenter today is Molly MacDonald, founder and CEO of the Pink Fund. Your learning objectives and outcomes. As a result of participating in this activity, the healthcare team will discuss with patients how non-medical cost of living bills can impact treatment decisions, describe the novel addition to financial toxicity framework and how it affects patients, apply learned strategies to mitigate financial toxicity, and propose available resources to breast cancer to assist them throughout treatment. If you have any questions, please type your questions into the Q&A box on your Zoom panel. If you'd like to chat amongst yourselves, you can begin to chat, maybe sharing a little bit on who you are and where you're from in the chat box. Questions in the Q&A box will be answered during the last few moments of today's webinar. And now we present to you Molly MacDonald.
Hi, I can't see anybody, but I'm really grateful to be here and speak with you today. I want to say before we begin that all country in the United States is the country belonging to the Native Indigenous peoples. And I know that in healthcare space, some of those people are often overlooked, not treated fairly. And so one of our goals in bringing in diversity in healthcare is to recognize that we are a country of many, many different types of people and individuals, both rural and urban. And we want to serve all of them with respect and care. So Mike, are you going to continue with the slides? Look at this. Oh, I love seeing who's here.
You've got control of the slides there.
You know what? I don't see the arrow. I apologize. Let's see.
Let's double check here.
Looking. It says I can control Mike Willett's screen, but yeah. I can't.
Press the space bar.
Oh. No. Let me see. Oh, look at that.
Does that work?
Right. Okay. That was my faithful assistant there, Rosalind. Okay, so my name is Molly MacDonald. I am a 18-year breast cancer survivor. I was diagnosed with early stage disease at a time of job transition. And I had been through a financially devastating divorce, left to raise 5 children ages 4 to 13 on my own. I reentered the workforce after being out 12 years as a full-time mom. And at the time of my diagnosis, I had no savings, no child support, no alimony, and like many Americans, was living paycheck to paycheck. So it was quite a challenging time for our family. And my early stage disease, by the way, was DCIS, which is known as ductal carcinoma in situ, which meant in the space of breast cancer that the cancer cells were forming in my breast tissue, and had it been left untreated, they would have formed a solid tumor and I would have had a much later stage of disease and longer treatment protocol. So I, sitting in these cancer waiting rooms, for treatment, and I met a lot of other working women who were on unpaid leaves. They had the benefit of the Family Medical Leave Act, known as FMLA, which, by the way, many hourly workers, certainly urban farm workers, rural farm workers, other hourly workers and small businesses don't have that benefit. And so if they're unable to work, they don't have a job to come back to often. And so these women were diagnosed with much later stage of breast cancer. So for those of you, and I'm looking at some of these people here, a lot of you already are familiar with cancer. But in the breast space, there are four stages. And by the time you get to stage four, it's known as metastatic, and that cancer has left the breast and moved into vital bones and organs. And it's very long treatment protocols, often with challenging outcomes and ultimately death. So these women that I met were considering stopping treatment and going back to work because they were making impossible choices about whether they would pay for their mortgage or their rent, their car payments. They were going to pull their kids home from college if they were at university, liquidate their IRAs or their retirement funds if they had those, and put their medical bills on their credit cards, which was going to make things very challenging. So I decided that I was going to start an organization that would give help, even though I was not able to get any help for myself. So I think we were going to show a video now, Mike. So this video that we're about to show you will really tell you what we do here at Pink Fund, and then we'll move forward, talk about a survey, talk about resources. Here we go.
There's more than one part of this fight. This disease is merciless. It simultaneously tries to take your body and the life you've built. It forces women to choose. How could anyone choose between their lives and their livelihood? Do I pay for the medicine or pay the mortgage? Can I miss a treatment? Or can I afford to miss work? Nobody should have to sit in a chemo chair, worried about how they're going to keep the lights on, or food on the table, or pay the lease on the car. Nobody should. And if we have anything to do with it, nobody will. There are plenty who raise funds for the research, and we thank them for it. But there's another part, because this fight takes more than medicine. Pink Fund, real help for the other part of the fight.
So that brief video, we don't need to see this next one. This is actually our spring campaign, and you can find it on our website, but we can X out of this, Mike. Move back to the presentation. Okay. So for many patients, they're making these impossible choices between their life or their life savings. And this is true for mostly a lot of oncology patients, but also others with disease states where they have long, toxic, and expensive treatment protocols. And that is an impossible choice to make. We know that our healthcare system is broken, but there are organizations like the Pink Fund and other resources where we try to step in and prevent this from happening. Now it won't go forward. I just hit my little button. Oh, there we go. So the impact of financial toxicity, and this is a term that was coined in 2013 by Drs. Yusuf Safar and Amy Abernathy at Duke University. And what they're really talking about, how I describe financial toxicity, is when lost income collides with high deductibles and co-pays, people are standing on the edge of a financial cliff about to go over. or you can consider it like drowning, like things are just, water is just rushing over you and you can't get out of it. So 42.4% of 9.5 million people diagnosed with cancer from 2000 to 2012 drained their assets within 2 years to cover the cost of their care. And 62% of all cancer patients are in debt because of their treatment. And 55% of them owe at least $10,000. In 2005, when I was diagnosed, as I mentioned, at a time of job transition, I had to go on a COBRA premium. And that COBRA premium in 2005 was $1,300 a month. And I could not make my house payment. So my house went into foreclosure. Within 3 months, I had foreclosure notices stuffing my mailbox. And every 58 days, my automotive creditor was calling me asking if I planned to make a car payment or should they plan to repo my car. And they worked with me extending my lease by 8 months. But when I went to turn my car in, because my credit report had suffered terribly, I had to buy a used vehicle, which was fine, but my interest rate was 29%. So both, you know, I was paying for this health crisis in many, many ways, a really bad credit report, which can follow you for years, by the way, especially if you need credit or want to rent an apartment or purchase a home or sometimes even get a job. If your credit report looks bad, some employers hesitate on hiring you. So the financial toxicity of a cancer diagnosis can be something that doesn't end when treatment ends. So 62% are in debt. We said 10,000. I owed 3,200, which in today's money would probably be about $10,000. And I made a payment plan with the provider, and I paid them $100 a month over 3 years. But I did face collect. I was afraid to answer the phone if it was a number that I didn't recognize. And that also terrorizes people and affects their mental health. So this is a study. So Mike, you're controlling the slides. I'm popping up the chat is popping up. So it's kind of in the way. Next slide, please. So I went home to my new husband. My new husband, I call him Tom Terrific, because you have to be terrific to marry a middle-aged woman with 5 children, night sweats, and a mildly demented mother. And I went home. He worked in the piano business, and he had an unpredictable income. He worked on the concert stage. So we never knew when we were going to get paid for his work. So I went home to Tom, and I said, I think we should start this nonprofit, and we're going to pay these patients' non-medical bills directly to their creditors for up to 90 days to provide a financial bridge. And he looked at me like, right, you've got 2 heads, or we just rescued the house from foreclosure and you're in line at the food bank to help feed the family. What are you thinking? And I always talk, I don't know if you've ever seen the Ted Lasso show, but that believe sign that's in the locker room. I believed I could. And I'm from Detroit, Michigan, and Henry Ford, of Ford Motor Company, has a famous quote that says, whether you think you can or you can't, you're right. And I thought I could. So I had this table that you see here from my former life, and I traded it for our heart and ribbon logo to the graphic designer. Because remember, I had no money. I just had an idea. Next slide. I had once been an executive at a daily newspaper here in Detroit called the Detroit Free Press. And so I called the medical writer. Her name is Pat Anstatt Kiska, and she still writes a lot about breast cancer. She has a book out there called BC Surgeries, What's Right for You. You can get it on Amazon. But Pat has been an advocate in this space. And I called her up and I said, I have this idea, and I cast up my bust before surgery. Actually, my husband did that. And I was going to go out on these bus stop speaking engagements to raise awareness of what we were talking about. And so as you see over there, it says, I'm not going to stand up and say I went through hell with breast cancer. What I went through hell about was all the financial stuff that was part of it. And that was the big challenge for me. So the disease was minimized by the financial challenges that we were facing and the potential for homelessness. And that was terrifying to me. So this story ran on the front page of the Detroit Free Press in what was then the women's section on October 2nd, 2006. We launched Pink Fund, and 27 newspapers picked up the story. Next slide. So I made a vision board in 2007, and I knew that the problem we were facing was not just germane to the state of Michigan, but that it was a national problem. And probably I thought we had to be national. And I knew that Ford Motor Company was in the space working with Komen, Susan G. Komen, for the cure. And I just put that Ford Blue Oval on my vision board. And in 2012, they picked it up and called me and said, we're thinking about diversifying our charity partnerships. We'd love for you to come in and pitch the Pink Fund's mission and value proposition. And I did that. Our organization at the time had one part-time employee. We were working out a donated office space. I was not paid, and I was still working a full-time job trying to help my family when Ford picked us up. And they manufactured 6,000 of those t-shirts that you see this man named James Denton wearing. And some of you may recognize James. He played Mike the Plumber on Desperate Housewives. The show actually ended in 2012. And through a series of curious events, I knew his wife, who was an exercise instructor in Pasadena, California. And I would go out and spend time with my good friend, Jane. I was trying to work on another deal with Chinese Laundry Shoes, and which never came to fruition, by the way. But we would go and exercise at the studio. And she would tell me, she said to me one day, well, our teacher is married to Mike the Plumber on Desperate Housewives, but they're not celebrity people, so don't say anything. So I didn't. And in February of 2012, I get a phone call from Erin Denton. She had asked Jane, I was always branded. So that's another thing. I was always wearing a Pink Fun cap. And Erin's sister, who was a nurse in Chanhassen, Minnesota, had been diagnosed with breast cancer. And she was not going to be able to work because her immune system was compromised. And Erin and her husband wanted to make a significant donation to the Pink Fund so that we could pay her sister Megan's bills. And unfortunately, I had to tell her, well, I cannot do that. We're only in Michigan at this point in time. And by the way, that's illegal. You can't designate who's going to benefit from a charity. So she said, well, did you know that James' mother died from breast cancer? And I said, no, I didn't. I had no idea. She said, well, she was a working widow when she felt a lump and had watched her mother go through terrible chemotherapy treatments in the 70s before they had some of the anecdotal medicines that prevent some of the nausea. And she thought there would be no way that she could work, and she had to work to support herself. So she didn't have treatment and she died. So now we had a story. We had a man who was well-known in the entertainment industry, with a mother who experienced financial toxicity and a sister-in-law who was having that experience in 2012. So Ford picked us up, made the t-shirts, put ads in People in Style. Us and Ladies Home Journal. So that ad ran a press in 2012, and that really launched us. And we're so grateful to Ford Motor Company. We're now in the 11th year of that partnership, and now it funds solely transportation assistance payments. So the next slide. So this is what we do. We provide financial support to breast cancer patients in active treatment, covering these very basic living expenses for housing, transportation, utilities, and health insurance premiums. And what I'd like to say is that we are not going to solve this health problem of financial toxicity. What we do is we help to stabilize these families for 90 to 180 days. So if you think about your life as a Jenga tower, and I don't have an illustration here to show you, but if you've played Jenga, you know that you pull out these rectangular pieces of wood. So you get this cancer diagnosis, and immediately the foundation of your life that you've carefully assembled and managed and tried to control is compromised. And not the middle piece of that rectangular piece of wood isn't pulled out. It's either the one on either end. And as you know, when you play Jenga, you keep adding to the top of the tower. So the pressure is building. And then you find out that that health insurance premium that you elected because you could afford the monthly premium has a very large deductible. Another piece comes out and the pressure keeps mounting. And now it's November, and you've been told by your oncologist that you really can't wait to start treatment or have your surgery until January. So now you're faced with two large deductibles. And by the way, you may not be able to work while you're in treatment. So all of a sudden, your life is full of these holes and the pressure is building and your life tower is just starting to wobble. So what we do is we come alongside and we basically kind of place scaffolding, financial scaffolding around the family. And we know anecdotally that it makes a huge difference, not only for them financially, but for their mental and emotional health. We also know that impacts what's called treatment adherence. So that means that the patients will stay on the treatment protocol as prescribed by the physician, and it improves their ultimate survivorship outcomes. Next slide. So another thing I had on my vision board was I learned of a researcher who's now at Emory University running the radiology program there named Reshma Jagsi. She was at the University of Michigan at the time and had done a study in two populations in 2014 between African Americans in Detroit and Hispanics in LA. And her research was all around financial toxicity and the financial challenges these two populations were having. Impacting their treatment and their survivorship. So I put Dr. Jagsi's name on my vision board. And in 2018, I was able to get an introduction. And by 2021, Dr. Jagsi and her colleague, Lila Garzai, did a small study using patients who had benefited from the Pink Fund. And these patients showed us gaps that were identified that they said were problems. And I'm going to tell you, and I know those of you in healthcare know all this already, but we learn from people in the industry. Yes, are there any quite fun programs for other cancers? Yes, I'll talk about that. Cancer care is a great one to go to, but we'll talk about that as well. We'd love to see our business model adopted by other disease states, cancer or not. So anyway, Dr. Jagsi and Garzai spoke to these patients and who, by the way, they were compensated for their participation in the study. They were each paid $100 because they had an hour-long interview. And they identified these four gaps that had those been addressed, those expectations, that it would have mitigated or lessened the financial burdens that they felt and certainly improved their mental health outcomes and treatment adherence. So the first one was incorrect expectations about how treatment would affect finances. This is really hard because physicians don't have that information. Sometimes in some provider settings, there'll be a financial navigator who might be able to answer some of those questions for you, but certainly not in the rural community oncology settings. They often don't have the finances to have a financial navigator and staff. So you can't get the answer. If I had asked how much is my care going to cost, I probably would have gotten a blank stare from my oncologist. So our advice now, things have changed quite a bit since 2005 when I was diagnosed, is to request clarity as much as possible on the expected costs and timeline. So when we think about this and we think about patients asking for clarity, that needs to be done not only verbally, but visually. So it would be really great if there was some kind of diagram that could show a patient, you know, you have your surgery, then maybe your chemotherapy, then radiation, and then especially in the breast space, if you have an ER positive diagnosis, you might be prescribed an aromatase inhibitor. Patients are afraid to ask. They're afraid often if they talk about money, like this lack of provider conversations about finances, that they won't get the best treatment. And in fact, we know from a study done by Lauren Hamill here at Wayne State University in Detroit, where she videotaped patients and their oncologists at the time the treatment plan was presented, that what the patient was most concerned about was inability to work and lost income. And the physician was most concerned about what the insurance would cover for the prescribed plan. Now, I know anecdotally and from people who've told me that sometimes when they have expressed concerns about finances, the response is, well, we could give you a lower dose of chemotherapy to lessen your side effects and make it so that you don't have to not, you can go to your job. But if you have side effects like neuropathy and you have a job that's physical, that's very, very challenging for patients. So that lack of provider conversations about finances, you need to ask. And here's the other thing we tell patients all the time. And in if you're in the provider setting, I suggest you give patients this opportunity to bring in an advocate. Sometimes a patient, particularly somebody who's an introvert, is afraid to ask. Maybe their understanding of their health and financial literacy just isn't there. And they're terrified. So often when we have a disease like cancer or any kind of health issue, we shut down emotionally and mentally. So it makes it very, very challenging. So we suggest that you take an advocate with you. Maybe that's a family member, somebody from your faith community, but somebody who will ask those questions so that you're not kind of put in the hot seat. The other thing we talk about while you're in the clinic with the patient and the physician, we suggest that you ask permission to tape the meeting. You will not remember everything that's said to you during your clinic visit. Also, if you tape the meeting and you compare it to the electronic medical record notes, you might find that there are some things that don't add up. So often there's been some research that shows that what's in the EMR record does not match what the patient heard. So that's another one. Then the third gap is the inability to identify financial resources. There again, that's where you need a social worker or a patient navigator in the provider setting who can help you, not only if the provider might have a program to provide resources like gas cards or food cards, often like that, or small community resources or national resources like the Pink Fund or Cancer Care. So that earlier question about other cancers or other diseases, in oncology, Cancer Care is a great resource to go in and look at what might be available to you in terms of the types of non-medical support that Pink Fund provides. For medical support, we suggest the PAN Foundation out of Washington, D.C. So PAN has support for various diseases, including breast cancer, and they have a program called Fund Finder. So you can go into PAN and you can register to get an email if the drug that you're on becomes available at a free or reduced price. There's another, the Health Wealth Foundation, MediMeds, and others out there like that. But your social worker or navigator, if there is one in a setting, should be able to help you identify some of these other financial resources. The challenge for patients is that they're going down multiple rabbit holes, filling out all kinds of applications and, you know, wishing, hoping, thinking, and praying that they're going to get the support that they just so desperately need. One of the things that I would love to see happen would be something like the Common App, where there's just one resource for patients to go into and all the nonprofits and community resources would be available. The other thing I want to mention is there's an organization called $4, and $4 will, or I'm getting ahead of myself, but $4 will help you if you go to a nonprofit hospital that gets federal funding. They will help pay, get your medical bills paid. So look that up, $4. So that's where I said the patient said, you know, seek out allied health providers to find resources for assistance and assistance outside of medicine through friends and philanthropic organizations. One of the things that we've learned is that patients often trust other patients with the same disease state than they do their healthcare provider. So often there are these great private Facebook groups where you can get on and ask questions, and they all of them will come back with support that you need. So I'm making this up, but if you live in Idaho and you're at a community oncology center, you can, you know, mention that. People will probably come forward with resources. So I really recommend some of these Facebook groups. And then finally, lack of support in navigating the healthcare system. This is huge because patient navigation often isn't in place in every healthcare system in this country. And patients, again, don't have either the wherewithal or the literacy to be able to perform navigating for themselves. So that's where you could look for these support groups on Facebook, or sometimes they're even within the provider institution. I know when I was diagnosed, they had a program called Sharing and Caring where we met weekly with a social worker, and that really helped our group get through. Next slide. So we decided that we needed to help people financially navigate breast cancer. We can't navigate them in a clinical sense, but we can help them navigate financially. So questions to ask. Instead of just saying ask questions, we're telling you exactly what wording to use. Know your care team, your social workers, your patient and your navigators, the financial counselors who may or may not be in the setting. I want to say one thing. If there is not a financial counselor or navigator, there may be somebody outside the provider setting in a social work setting that may be able to help. It might be another nonprofit in your area. I know that sometimes Komen can help with that. Living Beyond Breast Cancer sometimes has support for that. And the Young Survival Coalition works with women, young women who are diagnosed to help them navigate their diagnosis, treatment, and recovery. So this guide is on our website. You can get the code to the poster. We will send these out. And in about a month, it will be bilingual. So it will be both Spanish and English. And if you have any feedback for our guide, we would love that. This is how we learn and improve the work that we do in the breast space. By the way, these questions are good for any kind of oncology disease state, not just breast cancer. So next slide, please. So all of this is available on the website. Social workers and navigators can access our toolkit, our brochures, and our Just Diagnosed flyer. We know that we will also mail these out to you, or you can print them in your own setting. If you have any questions or anything about these resources, you can just send an email to info@thepinkfund.org. We would love to hear from all the navigators or people in the provider setting on the call so that we can work with you more closely. Rosalind Sample is our community outreach manager. And her email, which is not here, but I'll give it to you. It's Rosalind, R-O-S-A-L-I-N-D, @thepinkfund.org. And she will get you whatever resources we have. Next slide. So we have two basic programs at the Pink Fund. Our basic 90-day financial bridge program is for anybody in treatment. And this can include people who are in treatment for a clinical trial. So clinical trial is considered active treatment. And so if you're in a clinical trial and you need support, that's, you know, apply to us. And then we have the Mary Herzog Fund for Metastatic Breast Cancer. This is a fund for women whose disease has left the breast and entered the vital organs and bones and are unable to work and looking to go on to Social Security disability. They have been approved for Social Security disability, but they are in a mandatory 5-month waiting period where they cannot show any working income. So imagine not having any income for 5 months. So while we can't cover all their bills, that this fund will provide financial assistance of up to $6,000 or up to 6 months in direct bill payments. If you're stage 4, you can get your support in the 90-day program. So if you're not going on to SSD, but you're in stage 4 treatment for metastatic disease, our financial bridge program will serve you. So next slide. So what are the qualifications to get support from Pink Fund? The first one is that patients must be actively undergoing treatment for breast cancer throughout their funding. And that means surgery, chemotherapy, radiation. It does not include delayed reconstructions. So for instance, if you complete your treatment in June of 2023 and you decide in December of 2024 to undergo reconstruction, that is not considered active treatment for our purposes. It also does not include taking the long-term hormonal therapies to prevent recurrence. So again, active treatment, surgery, chemotherapy, radiation. Then the second one is patients and or their spouse or domestic partner must have been working at the time of the diagnosis and must be able to show a loss of working income. So while we know that people have additional expenses when in treatment for cancer, our program is predicated on the fact that income, very significant income, has been lost by somebody in the family that impedes their ability to pay their basic household bills. Then patients' household income must be at or below 500% of the federal poverty level based on the previous year's federal tax return. So we have that chart, which I'll show you in a minute, that's on our website. What I like about this is that there are many, many programs for people who are living at or below the poverty level in this country, but there are very, very few that rope in the middle class. In my case, when I was diagnosed, had I been able to avail myself to Medicaid, I would not have had my house fall into foreclosure because I would have been able to make the house payment. But I had to make this $1,300 a month COBRA premium. So I was making this impossible choice. Now that's not the case with the Affordable Care Act. You know, if you've had a change in circumstances, they do not base Medicaid on your previous year's tax return. And then we require a lot of supporting documentation, which is often burdensome for the patient, but we feel that we need to make decisions based on facts and not on narrative. So we require a copy of your previous year's tax return for the household. So that would be you and or your spouse and domestic partner. That does not include children in the home who might be working. So if you have children that are teenagers or adults working in the home, we don't ask for that. It's just really good to the patient, spouse, or partner. The second thing we ask for is proof that you are in active treatment. So we get that from your social worker or oncologist or somebody in the provider setting. That's either a letter we ask for. We do have a form on the website where you fill out certain spaces. And by the way, there are explainer videos on the website that will show you exactly where to place things on the application. We ask for a copy of your driver's license. We want the driver's license to match your domicile, your home address. And if you have a lease agreement, you're renting, we ask for a copy of the lease agreement. And then copies of all the bills that you would like paid. Do not send in the originals on the bills. So again, we pay housing, so that's mortgage or rent, transportation, that's car payments. We also will pay car insurance. So if that's something you need, let us know that. All utilities and health insurance premiums. The next slide, please. So here's that federal poverty level. You know, in some places in the United States, the major cities, this you are not at this level. In fact, I was just reading today that in order to live in New York City, you need a minimum of $100,000 a year. So clearly somebody making $72,000 at the federal poverty level. And Janice saying, PANS Fund Finder that Molly mentioned covers all cancers. Okay, she's right. Yeah, not just breast cancer. So the other thing I should tell you about PAN is that they also have an income level that's somewhere between 400 and 450% of the federal poverty level. So that's another reason why we kind of set that, because we could move people over to PAN Foundation to get medication assistance. You can see here that these numbers in certain zip codes in our country are fairly generous. And we obviously change this every year with the cost of living. So next slide. So here's the process for applying. Review the applications between the Financial Bridge Program of 90 days or the Mary Herzog Fund if you've applied for Social Security disability and been approved. Then you fill out and mail in the application with all the required supporting documents. This is a challenge for patients. Often they don't have those at their fingertips, and we've been told that they might come into their social worker with a bag of papers and everything has to be sorted out. And we know that's challenging. We're looking at changing some of those requirements, but right now everything is required, including, I neglected to mention, 2 months of bank statements. If you are unbanked, currently we cannot help you. So that is another challenge that we're looking at with our board of possibly removing bank statements as a requirement. Then, once your application is received, we will email you a notification, and there will be a timeline of what you can expect and how long it might take. So if everything arrives complete, including all the supporting documentation, your application would be reviewed easily and possibly approved within 30 days or less. So we have meetings on the second Monday of every month where the applications are reviewed by a team of volunteers and decisions are made based on our budget of what bills we're going to pay. And we always try to pay those larger bills first. Or if the patient indicates what's most important to them, then we will look at that bill as a first couple of bills to pay. So that goes to the committee. The next morning, all those applicants are notified of our funding decisions where we confirm this is your creditor, this is the account number, this is the amount, please confirm, and then the bill payments are sent out within a week or two of that. Next slide. So this is how we helped last fiscal year. As you can see, housing is a big one. We have helped people who have not had a home to live in, where they've been living in either their car with a family member. We helped one young woman who was living in a storage unit in California. So and all those people that were living in those various scenarios lost their homes. So they didn't get to us soon enough or they were evicted. So that's kind of, I think, the biggest concern that I had, certainly, and I think most people do, is what would happen if I don't have a place to live? And then transportation, 18%. You can see the numbers on the left side of the screen of how much we paid out last fiscal year, health insurance and utilities. What we've learned from patients, and this is again anecdotally, is that whatever bills we pay for them for 90 to 180 days brings them a huge sense of relief. And later in the presentation, we'll read a couple of the thank you notes that will give you a feel for the impact that our program makes on patients' lives. Next slide. So we gather demographic data. We have it just because we want to know who we're helping. And you can see on the ethnicity of patients that we don't have any American Indian or Alaska Natives who've elected to share their ethnicity with us. You see that 41% are not specified. So we have some concerns about that. One is we know that we're a nation of multiracial and multi-ethnic individuals, and they don't fit into any of these categories. Or our larger concern is we're concerned that they're concerned that if they disclose their race or ethnicity, that might knock them out of funding. And that is not the case. The reason we like to collect this data is to show that we serve a diverse population of patients. Many of our funders want to know that we're working with every race in this country, that we've made our program available. So that is the only reason we collect that data. Now, by age, that's a little different. The reason we ask about that is sometimes there's a higher prevalence of breast cancer in a certain age group. You can see that our largest age group is 40 to 49, and that's considered pretty young for disease. And then look at the 30 to 39 is 18%. And you can see as we get older women, and by the way, we do help men. So this year, about 2,000 men in the US will be diagnosed with breast cancer. And we will be doing a little bit more around that education piece that, you know, men are at risk and often neglect to feel their breasts, or if they find something, they don't think that's possible. The frightening thing for men is because they don't take any action if they feel something, they're often diagnosed at a later stage and they have a higher mortality rate. So what we're seeing now, you can see that 20 to 29% is 2%. What we're seeing now is younger and younger people are being diagnosed. So it'll be interesting as we go through the years how these percentages might change. Next slide. So self-reported education level, look at that, 2% grade school education. I remember we helped a woman in Texas, a Hispanic woman who had a third grade education. Her daughter applied for her. She was working for $7.95 an hour as a certified nursing assistant. And she was Hispanic speaking. And that just made me sick on so many levels. So again, we look at this, we just wanna know that we're helping this diverse population in our country. High school diploma is really high and postgraduate pretty low. And again, we got a little college and some not specified. And then this is by household income. The largest percentage is that 25 to 50K. That's pretty low. And of course, this doesn't tell us in this particular pie chart how many people are in the family, but that's low. That's hard. I don't know how people are living on $25,000 a year, especially with rents these days and the cost of housing. And then only 9% at the 75 to 100K. So again, this data is just interesting to us. It's interesting to our funders. It doesn't determine who we fund or who we take care of. Next page or next slide. So this is a map of how we helped. You can see how many people we've helped. And I have to tell you that I think this is from the beginning of when we started in 2007. So our first grants were made in 2007 in Michigan. And so you could, like, thousands, if you added all this up, pretty good. So when you look at this, some of these numbers may look low to you, but when you consider, for example, existence. Look at North Dakota up there with 23 people. We're really hoping to reach more people in rural areas and working hard with other associations and groups like yourselves to spread the word. Next slide. This is our growth through the years financially. You can see how small it was. Like, we didn't categorize how we paid out things in 2008 and 9. In fact, we didn't begin to do that until 16 and 17. So what I find interesting here is if you look at 2011, 2012, we paid out $68,000, and the next year it jumped to $228,000. And that is solely because of Ford Motor Company's support of our program. Last fiscal year, we paid out just a smidge over $1 million. You can see that down there. It was $1,000,004. So this year we're on track to pay out about $1,000,002. I will say that everything is predicated on meeting our revenue goals. So for example, if we're not meeting our revenue goals and we have to pull back a little bit and we can't make a house payment, we'll make car payments. If we can't make car payments, we make utility payments. We will provide some measure of financial support to every qualified applicant who applies and provides all the supporting documentation so that they have some measure of financial relief. And all of this is on the website, by the way, so you can refer to it later. Next slide. So to date, we've paid out close to $7 million. In fact, next month, we'll top that. Next slide. So these are the testimonials, and I was going to ask Heather to read them. Next slide.
So this one is from a woman named Rachel. The Pink Fund is a breath of fresh air. We got the wind knocked out of us when I was diagnosed with stage 2B breast cancer. I started treatment right away thinking I could still work, but quickly realized it would be impossible. I had to take 6 months of unpaid leave. And it's very stressful worrying about bills while you're sick. The Pink Fund has lifted a huge burden off my family's shoulders, allowing us to breathe and mend.
And we just have one more. I don't know.
This is from Don H. The mental stress is a big, if not bigger, than the physical aspect of coming to terms with cancer. Having financial assistance relieves a major stress factor so I can focus on the day-to-day instead of how we are going to stay afloat and not lose everything we've worked so hard for. We can't express our gratitude enough. It gives me more strength and energy to focus on doing what needs to be done to fight this thing and keep a positive attitude.
So this is where we know this is. And when we have our committee meetings where patients' files are being reviewed for funding, we have people read these, stand and read these thank you notes, because this is the real impact. We can tell you all day long how many bills we've paid to what creditors for what types of support, but it's this that keeps us going. And I don't know how you measure hope. But that, I talk about that all the time. Like, you can quantify and qualify what we do, but I don't know how you measure hope. And I think ultimately what we do deliver is hope. Next slide. So ask me anything, molly@thepinkfund.org. If you have any concerns or questions about how for patients applications, the email is grants, G-R-A-N-T-S, @thepinkfund.org. Our grants program is managed by our senior program manager, Carolyn Penja, who is a patient navigator. She has a degree in patient navigation. So I'm happy to answer any questions you have. Additionally, if you would like a copy of the University of Michigan study, I'd be happy, shoot me an email and I'd be happy to send that to you as an attachment.
Thank you very much, Molly. Thank you for the presentation today. If anybody missed out on the presentation, we will be doing an archive of it tomorrow. Also, if you attended today's presentation today, keep an eye on your email. You should be getting one from Zoom tomorrow, about 24 hours from now. And there'll be an evaluation survey in there that you can go ahead and complete. And once you complete the evaluation survey, there will be a certificate that is your accreditation for today's presentation. So keep an eye out for that. So if you have any questions, feel free to type your questions into the Q&A box, and we'll go ahead and answer those throughout the next couple of minutes here.
So I will say that I would suggest going to cancer care for any of the other cancer disease states as a first resource. They also list a lot of other resources.
Awesome. So just wait to see if there's any questions into the Q&A box here. We'll give it here another couple of minutes.
I will tell you that we were able to rescue our home from foreclosure, but that was because I had to ask my mother for money. But otherwise, we would have been homeless. And the other thing I would recommend to your patients, maybe some of them are already using food banks, but that was a real lifesaver for us. I remember, I was a privileged, educated white woman who had a series of unfortunate events, and a financially devastating divorce, left with five kids, and then cancer diagnosis and job loss. And I never imagined that I would be standing in line at a food bank, but it was so, I'm so grateful for that. And I think accessing resources is really important. You have to set your pride aside. You have to set your embarrassment aside, and you have to ask.
Absolutely.
So the care resource mentioned is cancercare.org, cancercare.org. The other great resource for those of you who are living in rural areas is the Community Oncology Alliance. And if you send me an email, I will connect you with Rose Gerber. They provide a lot of support. They have an annual conference, and they're great to work with.
Excellent. We're still standing by for any other questions. One person asked if the panfoundation.org is available in Alaska.
Yes.
Somebody asked that in the chat box, sir.
Mm-hmm. It's nationwide. You know what? They did an amazing program today on health equity. And Mike, I'll probably be able to send you those slides because they're going to send them to us. It was so well done. A real eye-opener for me and members of our team who watched it. And very insightful about how we treat people and don't treat people. So I'd be happy to send that to you. It might be CBS Specialty partnered with the Pan Foundation to put on that webinar. It was a lot to take in, but really important. A lot of it was about respect. Respect and honoring the humanity in everybody, regardless of where they come from.
Would you mind if we shared that information on keepitsacred.org on our website along with this
webinar? I will find out. Yeah, I will find out. I will connect you all with Amy Niles at Pan Foundation. She's vice president. They sponsored this. And then you can work also with Pan more closely to disseminate information on medication assistance.
Great. Cool. Yeah, we'll be happy to share that out on our website. For anybody that's interested, our website is keepitsacred.org. And we're on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram as well. We doesn't look like we have any questions or whatever questions we've had, we've already answered. Did you have any additional notes or thoughts that you wanted to share?
I have just one other thought, and that is if anybody is interested in what I call R&D, our program, which is rip off and duplicate, please contact me for other disease states. I think we have a pretty solid program. Fill in the pre-qualifying questions, and then as if you have cancer, and then look at the application, and please feel free to send me an email with any questions or suggestions. We're always looking to improve our program.
This person here asks, do you come out as a community partner to any clinic or facilities?
Well, we work with the National Coalition of Breast Cancer Centers across the United States. We are a member of the Metastatic Breast Cancer Alliance, which is another amazing organization of collaborative advocates and nonprofits working to improve the outcomes for women, well, for people with metastatic breast cancer. I'm on the board of the National Breast Cancer Coalition out of Washington, D.C., where a lot of advocacy work is being done and legislative work. For example, we are working hard to remove that five-month wait period for SSD disbursement of funds. Because as I said earlier, I don't know if you're a working person, how you cannot have income for 5 months and make it. National Breast Cancer Coalition also works with the Department of Defense, where $150 million in government funds goes into there for research. And I've sat on their panel as a consumer reviewer of research. And this is aside, but it really helped me to understand just how complex this disease is. I used to think at some point in my life, I thought, oh, yeah, there's a cure. They've got it. They've got a hidden cure. And after sitting as a consumer reviewer, I think breast cancer is probably the most complex cancer out there because of all the various types of the disease, subtypes, stages, and grades. Other collaborations, we're doing a lot more with other groups to make our mission known. And there's another group, another great group is survivingbreastcancer.org. They send out a monthly newsletter. Their founder, Laura Carfang, is a breast cancer survivor. And she, I don't know, she's a machine, but she has really great information. So you could subscribe to her newsletter. What did she say in the chat?
This person here says her friend in BC, or her friend has BC breast cancer, but has had a bilateral mastectomy.
Yeah.
So now she's facing more cancer.
She's metastatic.
Well, she qualifies.
She might qualify. She should apply.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And to answer this person's question here, we are going to archive this presentation. If you keep an eye on our website, keepitsacred.org, and go to our webinar archive tab, we'll have this uploaded and all that stuff by the end of the day tomorrow. So just keep an eye on our website tomorrow. We'll have it up to date.
So thank you all for the opportunity. I do hope that you will reach out to Rosalind Sample. Her email is in the chat. It's again, rosalind@thepinkfund.org to get any of the resources that we have, or go online and look at them there.
Fantastic.
Put it in again. Jennifer just put it in. Great. Rosalind is awesome. You might want to have her on a program sometime. She's a great speaker.
Excellent. Well, with that, we're at the top of the hour, and we want to thank everybody for attending today's presentation. We want to thank Molly and the Pink Fund for presenting their project today. And keep an eye on our website, keepitsacred.org, for the archive. Thank you very much, everybody. Have yourselves a great day.
Thank you. Bye.
To view the full webinar video and additional resources, please visit our website, keepitsacred.org, and click the Resources tab and the Webinar Archive tab. Thank you for listening to this Webinar Archive presentation from the National Native Network. Okay.
Look in a walk it, 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 in a hick a a, don't I see and don't.